Yep, so we've come to the Arahants today. So these are obviously, as you look at the refuge tree, the figures on the right. So I think looking at the reflecting on the Arahants and looking at the Arahants gives us a good insight into the Buddha himself and obviously into the early Sangha. Vishwapani's book is really good in terms of getting a sense of the early Sangha and the Buddha and the Sangha he was around at the time, and that's why I've got quite a bit of the stuff around the figure that I'm going to talk about this morning. So I'm going to talk about Mahakashapa. And I just to say, just briefly, in terms of the image and the Arahants, I always particularly notice with the Arahants and the Bodhisattvas that they're on the figures of the refuge tree, they're very obviously turned in and looking towards the Buddha. And even the figures above, even the sort of teachers of the path, I just really like the way they're sort of, not all of them, but they're kind of slightly turning in the direction of the Buddha, which I just think it sort of holds the image well. But I particularly notice it with the Arahants and the Bodhisattvas, particularly the Arahants, because they were the personal disciples of the Buddha. So I find that in the image, that's quite strong, that they're sort of looking directly at the Buddha. So Mahakashapa, so he seems to have had a similar. I'll just talk about the man a little bit. Then I'm going to talk about him as an ascetic. Then I'm going to talk about why the image of the ascetic or the forest dweller resonates with me. And then I'll talk a bit about how we can engage in areas of image and myth that we resonate with. So Mahakashapa, the man, he seemed to have a very similar upbringing to the Buddha. He had a very sort of royal background, so his father looked after him very well, and he seemed to have come from, at the time, a wealthy background. And similarly to the Buddha, he experienced a sense of sort of revulsion eventually and decided to go forth. Although, interestingly enough, he was actually married. He did have a, by the time, he and his wife both went forth, and they set off in opposite directions to seek a teacher. And it was said that in the Pali Canon that there was an earthquake, or there was a great tremor when Mahakashapa set out to find his teacher, which I like. So Mahakashapa, similarly again to the Buddha, comes across the Buddha sitting by the side of the road meditating. So it's said that the Buddha knew that Mahakashapa was coming and said, oh, something to the likes of, here, my disciple is coming now. And he sort of went to meet him, but sat by the side of the road meditating. And of course, Mahakashapa comes across the Buddha and has a very strong response. So Mahakashapa goes up to the Buddha, and he starts sort of communicating with him. But it's said that he has, Mahakashapa at this time has some silk robes on, so perhaps he hasn't quite gone forth in the way that the Buddha did. Well, anyway, he's still got his silk robes on. And I think the Buddha comments on the robes. So Mahakashapa immediately takes them off, and the Buddha gives him his really dirty rag robes, and Mahakashapa offers the Buddha these beautiful robes. But I just love this fact that Mahakashapa really revels in this and really takes the delight in that he's probably got these stinking, dirty, torn robes that are all kind of stitched together. So I just like that as almost like that's the beginning of his path. So Mahakashapa becomes renowned for his asceticism, for his ascetic practices. But I kind of like to think that this was the beginning of it, was the Buddha, he gives the Buddha his princely robes, and the Buddha hands over his rag robes, and that's like the beginning of Mahakashapa truly turning towards kind of a life of asceticism. So Mahakashapa was seen to be a foremost in ascetic practices and wilderness living.
So some of the early Sangha, not all of them, because apparently even in the life of Mahakashyapa, well, some of the early Sangha would live in the forest, dwell in the wilderness. And it said that the Buddha had some special, not special, some particular sort of codes or of the Vinaya, particularly for forest renunciates. And these were, wearing rag robes, not accepting nice posh robes from villagers. It says accepting only having one meal a day, but I kind of thought that they all had one meal a day, but anyway. Not accepting invitations for food in people's houses when, you know, often the Buddha and his Sangha would be invited around for dinner somewhere. But they wouldn't act, you know, they'd sort of, the villagers would know, I suppose, that some of Gotama's disciples, you know, wouldn't accept this sort of invitation. And not sleeping at night, but sitting in the meditation posture throughout the night. So having some tone of formal meditation posture going throughout the night, which of course you still see now with, or did with some of the Tibetan yogis and practitioners. But it seems that even in the Buddha and Mahakashyapa's time, there was a bit of a divergence. Some of the Sangha started seeing the benefit in staying in one place in a more settled, you know, very sort of primal, basic, monastic type living. And others were quite adverse to that and said that, you know, in the beginning we didn't have anything like that. We just dwelt at the foot of trees. We dwelt in the forest. We dwelt in shrubberies. And that was, you know, that was what we did. And they felt that. So there was a slight kind of, I don't think it was, you could say it was a slight split in the Sangha, but there was a definite movement. And Mahakashyapa was someone who was really keenly for this wilderness living. So he's sort of in a way, the embodiment of this kind of early striving. There's the verses in the Pali Canon. I've forgotten what the name of the verse is. It's basically the going forth, and the Buddha talks about the striving and going forth. And I feel that Mahakashyapa was a real embodiment of this, kind of early Buddhist striving. You know, they've met the Buddha. They've had a contact with the Buddha, with their, you know, the teacher of teachers, and they've gone off and they've sort of really gone for it. So they would go and live in the forest. Mahakashyapa would live in the forest. He wouldn't always live in the forest because he, like some of the other arahants, would gather his own disciples around him. But I'm just going to talk a little bit about the forest and what the jungle represented sort of to these people, but also in particular to other practitioners, what the forest, what the Indian jungle would represent. So it was primarily an incredibly feared place. It was somewhere that you just didn't go to, you know, you just didn't dwell in the forest. It was said to be full of all sorts of dangerous animals, poisonous snakes, nasty biting insects, tigers. It was supposed to be the abode of bandits and robbers and thieves who were sort of trying to get away from society, and they would just dwell there and then come out and do their mischief. It was also particularly, it was seen to be a very haunted place. The forest was a haunted abode. But these men and women would go particularly to the haunted places of the forest at the most haunted time of the year and meditate there, which I just think is just quite fascinating. So if the forest, what the forest represented to the community was this terrible place and all the bad things that could happen there. And it's like these disciples of the Buddha would go to those terrible bits of the forest and dwell there in the sort of ancient overgrown cemeteries and stuff that haunted. At the haunted time of year, they would sit there and meditate. And it was said that a lot of the community, just even other spiritual practitioners that weren't practicing under the Buddha, wouldn't really understand why the Buddha's disciples managed to go and live in the forest. How come they didn't just go insane? How come they didn't just, as I would do, walk 3 feet into the forest, you know, crap myself and run out? I couldn't think of a better word this way. You know, and just sort of run out. I'm sure that's totally what I would do. But it's interesting. I mean, I find this very inspiring that they dwelt there. And I was walking down the path towards Tad Ellis yesterday, the day before, thinking about Mahakashpa and this striving and overcoming fear. And I saw the dog that lives at the farm. It's this kind of golden Labrador. And it growled at me a couple of years ago. I walked past and it just went, and I was walking along and I kind of stopped. Oh my God, that dog's there. And I thought, what are you doing? There's a dog that growled at you 2 years ago. I'm walking along reflecting about Mahakashpa and this kind of, you know, this overcoming fear. And I'm thinking, oh, a golden Labrador. Yeah, interesting. I'll get to sort of, you know, what these myths represent to us as opposed to how to live by them. I think I'm wondering why they would do this, why would they live in these places? And just to, funnily enough, Maitre Raja in his talk used a quote that I had already written down that I was going to use it. I haven't nicked it, honestly. I forget actually if it's the Buddha or someone else said, remote jungle thicket resting places are hard to endure. Seclusion is hard to practice. It is hard to enjoy solitude. The jungle must rob a monk of his mind if he has no concentration. So I love that bit. The jungle must rob a monk of his mind if he has no concentration. So it's like, unless you've got some momentum and some practice behind you, you just couldn't do it. You just couldn't go into these places and live. I mean, the idea of having awareness and some sense of concentration in a place like that, I just find incredibly inspiring. So the question is, why did Mahakashpa and the other ascetics seek out these places? So we've got a little bit of a clue in the Theragata, which is the poems of the monks around at the time of the Buddha. Apparently, most of them were poets, but which I don't think they were. Anyway, so we have a little bit of a clue as to what was it, how these monks were able to live. Not even that, but what their experience of the forest was like. So for most people, this is a terrifying place. This is what Mahakashpa says. Those rocks delight me. The colour of blue clouds. Beautiful, cool with water. Having pure streams covered with Indigapoka insects. Like the ridge of a blue cloud. Like an excellent gabled house. Resounding with elephants, those lovely rocks delight me. Those lovely surfaces are rained upon. The mountains are resorted to by seers. Made to resound by peacocks, those rocks delight me. It is enough for me desiring to meditate, being resolute. It is enough for me, a resolute bhikkhu desirous of the goal. It is enough for me, a resolute bhikkhu desirous of comfort. It is enough for me, a resolute venerable one, desirous of application of mind. Being blue like flax flowers and like the sky covered with clouds, full of flocks of various birds, those rocks delight me. So I just love that. That just gives a little bit of a sense of what their experience of it was like. So you get this real sense of an incredibly refined, actually, sense of beauty and sense of delighting in this setting, delighting in the depths of nature and delighting in nature at its what will be seen as its most fearsome. But they just respond with that absolute sort of beauty in a way. So there's no fear and attachment. There's only a sort of a joy, a kind of uplifting of the heart in relationship to this place. So Sanghanisa was talking about Vajrapana yesterday and virya and striving. And I was thinking there's a real similarity between that and you know, this idea of these monks, Mahakashyapa, being this sort of embodiment of this striving. But I was also thinking about what's needed to make striving, well, what's needed for Virya to sort of work in a way. And I was thinking about the five spiritual faculties that you have Virya balanced with meditation. So you could see meditation as joy, beauty, happiness. So the two are very much sort of entwined, this sort of striving and this real sense of beauty. They're sort of, they're almost kind of one and the same in a way. It's also that these, you know, particularly Mahakashyapa, he was an arahant, and so he has a mind totally in accord with the way things are, totally imbued with insight into the nature of reality. So for him to dwell in this place, that, you know, there is no fear, there is no attachment, there is no craving. There's just the joy of what they're perceiving, their surroundings, and the joy at the very nature of their mind, in a way. So I was wondering, why does this myth of the forest renunciant talk to me if I can't even walk past the Labrador on the road? And I think it's something about it being the embodiment of total freedom. It's almost like a true embodiment of going forth. So it represents as a symbolism of, you know, going forth into these haunted, frightening places, almost like within conditioned existence, the worst place you could get is the place that these monks and nuns would direct themselves to. So that for me, it illustrates a sort of an embodiment of total freedom, that everything I see as frightening and terrifying, you know, they're quite happy to move towards with none of the attachments and fears. And there's something, about being solitary in the wilderness. I suppose I really like going on solitary. And for me, this does sort of, it does fit into a sense of, when I'm on solitary, I really don't like seeing anyone at all. I don't like sort of, you know, seeing anyone. I really like to feel that I'm just sort of in the elements. And I'm totally sort of away from people, and I'm not going to have any sort of contact with people, which is a little bit difficult unless you go right up to Scotland on solitary, which I don't tend to do. But there's something about sort of living in the English wilderness, but just living with nature and just having that sort of connection to nature and not being around anyone else, and just beginning to rely upon your relationship with nature, to beginning to rely upon your practice. And that there's this, I think there's a symbolism or the sort of metaphor of that, of just not seeing anyone, not having any contact whatsoever, even if it's just seeing a farmer a couple of fields away. That sort of affects me when I'm on solitude, because I just want to feel that I'm totally isolated from the world. There's something in particular about Mahakashyapa, the fact that he's an arahant, and don't know what it is. Just his image in the other refuge tree painted by Chintamani, that's at Adishtana. In the arahants, Mahakashyapa really looks like what I would imagine him to look like. He's got his robe kind of wrapped around him, sort of coming under there, and he's kind of looking straight ahead with these quite sort of wild eyes. And there's just something of the cut of his robe that it's coming right across him to sort of keep him warm. But I just have a sense that a man like him could only exist in the jungle, could only exist in this place. He couldn't really, it said that he was a little bit cantankerous, and he was said that after the Buddha's death, he led the Sangha, and in the first council, that he was quite critical of Ananda for some of the things Ananda had done, which didn't look like a huge deal to me, but he was quite critical of Ananda. So I get a sense that being around Mahakashyapa, some of the Sangha would have been a bit kind of, you know, he would have been a bit of a frightening presence almost. So he's fully enlightened. He's got this real thing about striving and effort. But it's, for me, him dwelling in the jungle, in this wilderness, feels like, to me, like the only place he could be. It feels like, you know, that is, the jungle is almost like a symbol of his mind. So totally enlightened, totally free, this kind of chaotic place that for anyone who hasn't got insight appears totally frightening. So it's like enlightenment to me. Insight into the nature of reality, it appears threatening and frightening and not a safe place to my mind. But for this figure of Mahakashyapa, you know, the jungle is completely the opposite. You know, he's sort of dwelling with these sort of irrepressible deep forces of nature, with this chaotic sort of, the chaotic sort of unknown, which I also feel to be a sort of metaphor of the enlightened mind in a way from a particular angle. So the image of Mahakashyapa in the jungle on his own, surrounded by this jungle, it's just an image and a metaphor and a symbol that totally works. It feels totally kind of sewn up, if that makes sense. You know, the enlightened mind living in this place, but particularly Mahakashyapa's enlightened mind dwelling in this place. It's also interesting as well that, as the Buddha said, when beings gain enlightenment, there'll still be certain, I'll be careful how I talk about this because I'm sure someone will be able to rip me to bits on it. There's still certain traits present that aren't based on greed, hatred or delusion, but there's still certain sort of, you could loosely call them character traits present. So it's not as if everyone becomes ding, like this, oh, I don't know, this blank canvas kind of slightly gormless enlightened being. It's almost like the different, you know, with the five jinnas and with all the figures on the refuge tree, they're all completely different, but they all have this deep sort of seeing into the nature of reality. So, you know, Moggallana and, oh, what's the other one? Shariputra, they were very good at teaching. It said that Ananda, although he gained enlightenment after the Buddha, you know, he served the Buddha, service was something. Even the Buddha himself, you know, it's like his wisdom and teaching was seen to be, I mean, many things, but what was foremost, his ability to communicate the Dharma so deftly. And for me, Mahakashyapa, there's something about the wilderness of the enlightened mind. Okay. Okay, so I've not much more to say. I was just thinking about how to engage with how to sort of engage with these figures. So, you know, if I'm engaging with a figure like Mahakashyapa, if it's a figure that really talks to me, well, what do I do about that? Do I go and try and spend more time on my own in Ted Ellis eating squirrel poo, or, you know, it's like, well, what do you do with that? Do I become a bit heavy and severe and sort of, you know, that just wouldn't work, you know, these, to sort of try and incorrectly take on these myths. I think you've got to be quite deft, and I'm not saying I am, by the way, but one's in approaching different figures on the refuge and being affected by them, or being affected by deeper inspirations or callings. You have to be quite clever and reasonably on it and in good communication with your friends to know what to do with that response. So yeah, it just wouldn't work for me to get to, I mean, I can manage about two nights camping even one night before I start getting grumpy and just don't like being outside and it's a bit grim. But there's something about this Mahakash being the wilderness, these beings living in the wilderness that really communicates at the same time. But I think it's, yeah, as I say, it's quite important not to take these callings or these inspirations too literally, to try and see what is it that they're pointing to. So to try and imbue oneself with the poetry, with the imagery, with the myth and symbolism of your responses, and just to try and dwell with that. And it's almost like we don't need to do an awful lot to allow these figures to really affect us and communicate to us. It's like, you know, you've all asked for ordination, or you ordained, and you know, you have a practice. It's not like if you'd be affected by a figure, you need to totally change your life around and become like that figure. I mean, you might have to do that, but I think I'm just talking about how to, just ways of letting these figures talk to us. Particularly, I think, through looking at images, reading poetry, talking about, reflecting on, meditating on these figures, and really sort of trying to see, well, why is it you respond to these particular figures? I've been mentioning this before. So you could say that these figures are trying to tell you something. So we need to try and find out why is there a connection there? What is it trying to tell me? What's this figure drawing out of me? And try and find out what is this figure trying to communicate to me. So you may need to change something in your life. You may not. I mean, I'm very inspired also by the myth of the artist, and but at the same time, I couldn't live like Arloka does, just painting all day, every day. I just couldn't do that. I don't know what would happen, but I'm aware that I just couldn't do that. I need other parts of my life. I'm, you know, so it's enough for me to have a bit of a space in my room where I can create some imagery. So that's like enough. That feeds my artist myth. And it's the same with, I know it sounds slightly daft, but it's even going out on a bike ride for an hour or so and getting off the road, not off the roads, onto some of the quieter roads. And, you know, you can be cycling for like 40 minutes and you won't see another being. And I just find that it's like, on a certain level, really chunking it down, the Mahakashpa wilderness myth and pottering around the nice back roads of Norfolk. It's like, well, that works for me, you know. That helps imbue my practice with a little bit of a sense of wilderness. But I think it's just important to see what is it that's being communicated, and just feel that, do I need to change anything to let that in more? What can I do to let it in? Or is it okay? Is it like, oh, I'm sort of getting enough of that, so to speak. If that makes sense, we can talk about it in the groups, I suppose. I was wondering about Mahakashpa, you know, do I need to try and, oh, I think I do enjoy meditation more. I do enjoy meditation, but I feel there's much more to be had. I need to make a little bit more of a concise effort, be a bit more creative with what is it I'm doing with my mindfulness breathing? Why is my mindfulness breathing so hit and miss? I know how metta bhavana can work for me, but why am I just impatient? So just, you know, just finding that joy more in meditation, in terms of, well, Mahakashpa dwelt in this place. And you know, these poems are full of, you know, Buddhist monks dwelling in wilderness and just loving it, just loving the meditation that kind of keeps them alive. So, you know, what does that say to me about what I need to do with my meditation? So just to finish up, in terms of responding to these figures, just try and have a sense of getting beneath the fact that I like that figure. So, for example, I like Avalokiteshvara. Just trying to get underneath, trying to make it more than that. Why do you like it? It's almost like someone's ringing a little bell in the distance and you can hear it, But if you move towards that bell, it's going to get stronger and stronger. And, you know, the vibrations of it are going to hit you the closer you get to it. So as opposed to it being, oh, quite like Avalokiteshvara, it's actually moving to make a bit more of a conscious effort to follow up our inspirations and our sort of our myths and symbols. And just finally to finish, I think with the refuge tree, all of the images, all of the figures are. I suppose I'm not just talking about just being inspired to try and make our lives a bit better. I'm talking about trying to be more inspired in relationship to the goal, in relationship to the central figure, which is the Buddha. So if you're inspired by Yogi Chen, well, what is Yogi Chen in relationship to the Buddha? What's it about him and his practice that ignites you? But what was he doing with his life? He was turning towards the Buddha. Atisha, Nagarjuna, they're all there, Manjushri. They're all turning towards the Buddha. There's all this sense of... So what is it about these figures that can tell us about the goal and tell us about deepening our practice? Okay, thank you.